East Carolina Manuscript Collection, Oral History Interview, Reel Number 2 of Interview with Captain John Henderson Turner, United States Navy Retired, conducted December the 13th, 1973, approximately 30 minutes on this reel.
You get up ahead of the convoy. This is on a night surface attack, and try to, having determined what general course it was making good, try to arrive at a point about 2 miles off of that course, and then head in directly, pointing directly at the closest escort, to present as small a picture as you could, a small visual target. Turn off the engine, get on the battery, seal the ship up so that you're all ready to die. And when you get about 3 miles from the escort, you opened all the torpedo doors, and you were ready to pull the trigger anytime. And kept just coasting in very slowly. And you tried to stay a mile or so away from that escort. And as he, after you got on his beam, if he wasn't worth shooting, you'd let him go by and scoot in under his stern, because his attention is more up ahead than it is astern. It's a human nature. Scoot in under his stern and get inside of the screen to the ships they were protecting, and fire the torpedoes out of the bow into those ships, and turn rapidly and fire the torpedoes out of the stern and hope that you got them all off before the first one started to hit, because when the first one's hit, that's when everybody started charging around, searchlights would go on, depth charges would drop.
You wanted to dive immediately upon relieving your...
You wanted to be ready to dive, but you wanted to then get outside the screen again and run. If you could do that, then you wouldn't have to take a depth charge.
Well, you ran on the surface as long as you felt it was safe to do so.
Unless you felt that you'd been sighted. The guy started shooting at you, or a searchlight came onto you, and steady, this type of thing.
You knew it was time to go down.
If you could stay on the surface, there's a point of judgment that you could avoid the depth charge. If you dove, the chances of getting depth charge were pretty good. I don't know, but they were better than if you stayed on the surface.
Well, were you ever spotted before you had an opportunity to torpedo?
Yes.
In that case, did you go ahead and try to torpedo, or did you just try to flee?
Well, by the time I got to be a skipper, my idea was it was better to shoot the escorts and get them all confused, and then come back again and take a pop at the ships. Every skipper has one. These were steam torpedoes, and they had two speeds. One was a slow speed and one was a high speed. And at high speed, they had a range of about 4,500 yards, which is over 2 nautical miles. At low speed, they go almost 6,000 yards, or 3 miles. And if with a very deliberate solution, radar of the tactical problem, of the fire control problem, to sit off at this great distance and fire in through the screen into the ships in the convoy and not try to penetrate the screen. But of course a small error in target course or target speed might cause you to miss.
Well, if you missed and it didn't explode, of course they would be none the wiser.
Well, at the end of the torpedo's run, it exploded.
Well, now, when it exploded, how would they know what direction it came from?
Well,
if they had not spotted it prior to its
steam torpedo and electric torpedo, too, at night, in most waters of the world, really, there's a lot of phosphorescence. And that torpedo looks like a headlight when it takes off out of the bow of the ship, going through the, particularly in the tropics where there's lots of phosphorus.
That's what I said, if they had not spotted it prior to its exploding.
But the escort, the phosphorescence lasts for a while. It's just streaked through the water. And the escort would spot that wake and turn and come run right down to it, away from where the ship had been hit, you see. Objective was to get away from the firing point as rapidly as possible. And when you were submerged in the daytime, if you sighted a target, if your speed is considerably limited submerged in a World War II type submarine, you rarely ran during an attack at speeds higher than 6 knots. So, because you drain the battery so rapidly, and the battery only has so much electricity in it, and when you run out, you have to surface to charge it again. So, you take the initial bearing on the target when you first sighted it, which usually in clear weather would be just the tip of the stack or tip of the mast. Head right for it and see which way it was drawing. Then take 90 degree to that bearing and run at high speed, as high as you state of your battery permitted you to. And run for say half an hour and then come up and look and see if you could see the target, if it was getting closer, if it was coming your way. If you couldn't hold the bearing, that meant you might have to really get down deep and run as hard as you could. So to try to get as close as you could to the target before you shot. And if you were able to, say you were up pretty close to the track of the targets coming along, then you could try to seek a point about, 700 or 800 yards from the target and just forward of its beam when you shot, and try to be pointed right at the target when you shot, so that you would reduce the number of errors from the torpedo's course and the simplest torpedo shot is called a straight bow shot, and it's just like shooting a bow and arrow. You just shoot the torpedo exactly straight and leave the target by the amount of degrees you figure the speed is. You can take ranges with a periscope optically, could then. And towards the end of the war, there was a periscope that had a little, it had a bigger head than the attack periscope, but it had a little radar station too, so that you could take a radar range at, oh, maybe 3 miles or something like this, because the optical ranges were not that accurate. Bearings were always very accurate, but the range, in essence, in the fire control solution, had a great amount of influence on what speed you thought the target was making. So if you could get a couple of radar ranges, then you could get the target speed pretty closely, and the target speed determines what angle you leave the target by to hit it. You learn all of this at submarine school.
One thing that I was curious about, on the occasion when you were depth charged and you lost your periscope and your compass, you still could have made radio contact if necessary.
Yes, our radio was all right, although we had to rig a jury antenna, because the antennas had been knocked down. And when we surfaced that night, the only thing we had to tell us whether there was anything around was the sonar gear. We couldn't see anything.
That was
a little hairy coming up.
And you had, how long did you remain down without the periscope?
From dawn, through the day, through the night, through the next day.
Well, now, did you think that there were enemy, after you had the depth charging had ceased?
It didn't cease.
Oh, well, they just continued?
It continued for about 24 hours.
And usually they had you down.
Yeah.
Had they been able to hear your
Well, I think they were pinging on us, you see. Echo ranging. In fact, another
one. Following you.
Following us along. I think he ran out of depth charges.
And so you really took a chance in coming up even when you did.
Well, no, we hadn't heard them for a long time. But it was still daylight. We didn't know where we were. We were afraid of airplanes. We weren't too far from an airfield.
And there wasn't too much you could do in getting a bearing during the daytime.
That's right.
Anyway, so
that's right.
It's a matter of staying there if you could.
The harbor came along. Staying at the Halekulani Hotel, which is down on Waikiki Beach, and there's a lovely little place with just little cottages. In fact, we were there 2 years ago to go to where we had our honeymoon, and it's the last of the little hotels that were there when we were there. Pearl Harbor Day was very confusing Sunday there, and the next morning she went from her cottage over to breakfast, and there were all sorts of rumors going about the Japanese were landing on Oahu, and they were landing here and landing there. They were going to attack again, this type of thing. And after breakfast, she went back to her room, and the Japanese houseboy was in there cleaning up the room. And about this time, a couple of airplanes came by right down the beach. And he ran over and looked out the window. Said, "It's all right, Missy, they're ours." And she didn't know what he meant.
I was getting ready to say. What did he consider?
He considered himself an American, as most all of them that I have ever heard. They were very strong Americans.
I imagine that the families of naval officers were under considerable strain.
Well,
throughout the war, were they not?
Yes, this is true. They were, well, for instance, my wife did not have any communication from me from early December of 41 until May of 42. And I had none from her until late May, I guess it was, or June. But we would, when we got into port, we'd see somebody who had seen somebody and pick up information about this. And as boats went back to the States for repairs, then those families would find out, well, so-and-so was all right in January because I saw him in Surabaya or something like that.
Well, even when you were in port, you were unable to write or
no, you
call?
Could, yes, that was all right. But the mail service wasn't very good. And I don't know whether you remember it or not, but they had things called...
V-mail,
yeah. And that came through pretty fast. But letters took quite a while. Ellen wrote to me every day. So when I come in from 2 months at sea, I have a stack of mail to read. Yeah. Huh. But I'd write usually about well, once a week or so, maybe a page. Send the whole bundle in when I got into port, and then write a couple of times in port.
Well, now that type of correspondence would be censored too, would it not? Mm-hmm. Because it was coming from the war zone, even though it's
the only thing you could say was I've seen so and so, and this would say, well, they're all right. There would be friends, and so she would write to the wife, and occasionally you could say, well, I've seen so-and-so who just came from the States, and she might know approximately what area they were going to, so this would help. But you tried to obey the censorship.
Right. Yeah.
And one of the reasons I think that we didn't lose more submarines than we did was because they were pretty good about not talking too much. The Japanese did not set their depth charges deep enough. And we found this out early. Stay underneath them.
So they would have realized that rather quickly.
Well, they didn't. And this was a well-kept secret. Everybody in the submarine force kept it too, because
that's a matter of survival.
That's right.
Of those officers you served with, both your superior officers in the command and your colleagues, any of them who made a particular impression upon you as far as unusually competent or unusually colorful? Or
well, yes. skipper of the first submarine I was on during the war, the Sculpin, had come to the ship within a few months before we went to the Philippines. His predecessor had gotten sick, and the skipper that originally commissioned the ship had 2 years, and this was a normal tour for him. And but this first combat skipper was a man by the name of Lucius Chappell, and he was from Georgia. Talked with a very soft voice, never got mad, never got excited. And, I admired him a great deal. He taught me a great deal. And, still correspond with him. Was a professor out at Monterey in California. And he retired about 3 years ago. He's lost the sight of one eye now. In fact, he had to have the eye removed. And he, I thought, was probably one of the finer officers I've ever met. Real steady citizen in a tight spot. You meet lots of chief petty officers, for instance. When I went to the Sculpin as a new ensign, there was a second class gunner's mate on there by the name of Casario. And actually the last two submarines that I commanded, he was the chief of the boat. The chief of the boat on the submarine is the top petty officer, chief petty officer. And he's the strong right arm of the executive officer. And he makes the boat run, really. Casario and I were together off and on four submarines because he was excellent. I admired him a great deal. Many of the men that were on the Sculpin when I first went to the were later
submarine service was small enough that it was a kind of like a private club, was it not? As far as
the Navy, when I graduated from Naval Academy, the Navy had 6,100 line officers in it, approximately, and after World War II had been going for a year or so, this number had grown 20 or 30 fold. The Navy, when I graduated from the Academy, you knew about at least half of the officers in the Navy by their reputation or by their name. If they were in submarines, everybody in submarines knew everybody else in submarines. There weren't that many of them.
That's what I meant by being a
then with a tremendous influx of very fine reserve officers and enlisted men that had come up and been commissioned. This was a tremendous expansion. And during the war, you were at sea so much you didn't get to see very many other people. So when the war was over, you knew the people you'd known before the war started, plus those that you had been in port with in various places in the world. And with a tremendous demobilization, many of these people that you hadn't known went back to civilian life. And many of the men who were commissioned during the war went back, either took their went out into civilian life with their rank or went back to the rank they'd had, some lesser rank. And it was quite a turmoil. I think now, probably those people who are active in submarines know most of the other people in submarines. It's not that big anymore. Mm-hmm.
Return to say the way it was on the eve of the war.
Somewhat follow now. I think they tend to, those who are nuclear qualified tend to run together, and those who are not tend to run together, and those who are more in the Polaris program tend to run together against those that are more in the attack submarine. And this is same as aviators or anything. Those in the history department in the college tend to run together.
Not true. The submarines that, as they were at the beginning of the war, with all of their inadequacies, had they changed basically much, say, since World War I period?
Well, some of the submarines that fought in the early part of World War II were World War I submarines. In fact, Admiral Davis was skipper of a World War I type submarine in the early part of World War II and fought with that submarine at Rabaul. You should talk to him. Man in World War I. Was commissioned, and after the war was over, they had examinations to see if they retained their commission or went back to the previous rank, and he passed the exam. He was very, he worked like a dog for a year getting ready for the exam. Strong technically as a machinery and electrical expert. So he became the repair officer of the leading Navy Yard. And then came back from there to Washington and was in the then Bureau of something or other, I don't know what it was. Submarine desk man. He had all of the planning and the technical overlook of the planning of overhauls and new submarines and new equipment.
So you were largely born in the submarine.
Yes, I was. Thank you.
Was he still active when World War One broke out, or he retired?
No, he died when I was at the end of my junior year at the Naval Academy.
He was, that was prior to his retirement. He was still in the Navy.
Been in the Navy 27 years. He joined the Navy to go around the world with the Great White Fleet, Teddy Roosevelt's day.
Really?
You don't have too much time to write. You always seem to be either busy or dead tired.
I suppose that's why so few kept diaries.
I've got a diary that I started much against regulations.